I'm DeMelo Roberts, stage and studio on Arts Watch.
Thank you so much for being here today. I'm Christina Wong, and I am a self-proclaimed food bank influencer.
I've talked with my guest, Christina Wong, the three times that Boom Arts has brought her shows to Portland. The first was Wong Street Journal and then Sweatshop Overlord. And now she's coming back to Portland with Food Bank Influencer, which runs May 26th through June 7th at Portland Center Stage. This is the second co-production with the two theaters, Boom Arts and Portland Center Stage. This new show, Christina Wong, Food Bank Influencer, explores the emergency food system from a personal and nationwide lens, looking at America's food insecurity and so much more. Christina Wong, actor, playwright, performance artist, Doris Duke Artist Award winner, Guggenheim Fellow, and the first Asian American woman to be named a Pulitzer Prize finalist in drama. Yay! Welcome to Stage and Studio on Arts Watch, Christina.
Yay! Thank you for reminding me. This is my third time bringing a third show to Portland. It is. I didn't think
there was another one, but yeah.
It was the Wong Street Journal. It was Christina Wong Sweatshop Overlord, and now it's Christina Wong Food Bank Influencer. So,
and I did see the video that you did of your performance at when you were running for public office.
Yes.
That was a fun one too.
That was Christina Wong for public office, and that premiered February 2020. So it mostly had its life during the pandemic when I had to adapt it to Zoom for my house.
Like so many of us, right? So, and an artist just makes art no matter what, right? So we do what we have to do, and you do it incredibly well. So let's talk a little bit about, I was going to mention that the performance artist part, but also you're such a dynamic and caring performer. When did it occur to you that... I don't know. You could try to solve major social issues through performance and comedy.
As I cackle.
No, because, we never know when that spark is. But what do you think it was?
Yeah, I'm shocked, I guess, because it is true. I guess I come across as a very generous and caring person because of these shows where I'm like, oh, no, there's a pandemic. I'm going to start a mutual aid group and we'll sew 350,000 masks over the course of 500 plus days. Or in this case, I'm gonna, tackle this issue of emergency food systems and stuff. When did this happen? I don't know. I will say that, like, in all the shows, I play a character named Christina Wong, who is me. But I have noticed, like, if I were to dramaturge my own work and study it, I'm like, I'm consistently this character that very naively goes about making the show to explore this topic. And everything blows up in my face because everything is way too complicated. So Wong Flew the Cuckoo's Nest, which I never brought to Portland, was a show I brought on for 8 years. But when I started, usually these processes start with me saying, okay, I'm going to have this show. It's going to be about this. And then I go through it. And so this was about depression and suicide, which at the time there was some research study that had been published about how young Asian American women, college age Asian American women, which I was that age at the time I made the show, were like second highest risk of depression and suicide. And went into it like, okay, I can't wait to do the show. I'm going to get those community awards. I'll tour this. People will tell me I'm so brave. And it totally blew up in my face in that I never really thought of, people kept asking, is this really about you? And I'm like, of course not. No. My mother was like, don't tell anyone. We're so proud that you got all these awards to make this show, but don't talk about me in the show, which is like, how do you make a pornography without sex, right? Like, how do you talk about depression without any mention of your mother? And
I'm sorry. That's so true. It's so true. And plus, mental health is just such a taboo subject in most cultural communities, yes. But Asians especially
ours.
it's like bad luck, you don't talk about it.
Yeah, you just act like everything's fine. And same with food insecurity, which was this particular show's subject. I never really thought of myself as food insecure, but as I the sort of impetus for this show started with me being really fascinated with a food bank, which looks like a grocery store in my neighborhood of Koreatown, and called World Harvest, and then beginning to really kind of examine shame and the moments in my life when I actually was eligible for food stamps but didn't apply because I just thought that, oh, that's for somebody else. Yet had developed a whole bevy of ways to get food, especially in college. I ate from Hare Krishnas. I went to events. I went on dates, right? Like, you know, there is all sorts of, there are ways you find to get food that feel, for whatever reason, less shameful. What does this have to do with me being a generous person? I don't know. But I guess I've always been interested in social issues and activism and finding a way to address them that feels more inviting and creative and than just screaming no, an invisible man who's not showing up in the room. But often what happens is these issues, I realize, become bigger and bigger and bigger and are too big for the show and too big to solve with just a show alone.
I think the generous part comes for me from observation that you begin with your neighborhood or a community group and you're just working with them. I mean, not essentially with the idea of doing art, but just to do some good or to create something that needs to be happening at the time, like your food bank or like with sewing masks during the pandemic. And so to me, it's like, is that part of your development process? I mean, do you go into these thinking, well, this would be a good play? You know, I don't know that.
Well, usually, you know, I remember when the sewing the mask started. So I sewed my first mask on March 23rd, on March 2020. And March 24th, I created a Facebook group. Maybe it was March 20th. But basically, within the span of less than a week, I went from trying to do something, getting overwhelmed by requests, trying to find help, starting a Facebook group, thinking this is just a stop gap, and then realizing like basically we were just a Band-Aid for huge systemic issues of health inequities and poverty and, you know, and just rural access issues, like all these things that we were, you know, this little thing just got bigger and bigger, right? And people were like, at the first week when I'm running around like a, you know, chicken with a head chopped off, people are like, is this your next show? And I'm like, who wants to relive this? I don't want to relive this. Who wants to relive this pandemic when this is all over? And I'm making a show about it. And it was a little bit by accident is that some theater companies were filling their virtual seasons. And I was just, the stuff I was witnessing was so crazy. I just started to write it down and performed it over Zoom. And then, you know, the sort of just ad machina of it was New York Theater Workshop asked me to premiere it live as their first performance coming up, reopening in New York. And so that's where tons of things opened up, like the Pulitzer and finalist nod and a lot of awards and the opportunity then to make this show.
Well, it was a chronicle of the time. And I think it was an important chronicle of the time because, you know, most people won't forget about the pandemic, which is understandable, but we did live through it. And there were so many human stories that came out of it. And I think it's important to remember that history.
Oh, totally.
I think your piece really spoke to that so much so that I just felt like the audience I was in tears through my mask. I was crying, but it was because I felt like, yes, we did live through this together and it was community trying to solve some of this, but also there was a lack of human connection and your piece really brought that to home, especially when you talked about the auntie sewing squad and how some of them didn't make it.
No, we had aunties who passed away.
And you showed pictures of real people, and it wasn't just names. It wasn't just masses of women that were sewing with you. You knew each one, you know? And so I think it was important, and it still is important, chronicle of that time. And maybe 10 years down the road, somebody's going to perform it and go, oh, okay, that's what that history.
It won't be me, because I'm I'm pooped.
Yeah, exactly. But maybe somebody will.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was a really profound moment for thinking about creating. And it was so weird that show came out of that time because it was, I guess, before that pandemic, every show felt like the most important thing in the world to me. And the pandemic, it was like, oh, my burgeoning theater career is like comes fifth next to people being alive, humanity surviving this, right? People being healthy, the systems and infrastructure that we are accustomed to coming back. And you may think in a way, because it was like the fifth most, it dropped in importance, I was actually freer to write because my ego, I guess, wasn't as tied up in it. I was just like, aren't we just happy to be back to watch this in person? Like, at least at the point that we did it in person.
I can see that. And also, you know, something that you said, you create a character that is you, but it's also a character. And when you're writing something that's so, I won't say, you know, so hard to talk to people about, but somehow doing it through art, you know, makes that emotion available to you because you're looking at it a little bit more objectively.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, totally.
So tell me about that process, because I understand it for myself, but I think it's something hard to describe.
Yeah, I guess I try to think about it in the terms of this new show, Food Bank Influencer, which is about food insecurity. And again, it started because in the pandemic, when I was running the mask sewing group, that food bank I described, World Harvest Food Bank, was a huge part of our ecosystem. And we didn't just sew masks, but we were doing relief supply drives to the Navajo Nation, to the border, to farm workers. And because this particular food bank has such a non-traditional model, it's not part of the Feeding America network. You do have to volunteer or make a small donation in order to get, you know, massive amount of groceries. And because it relies so much on private donations, Glenn Corrado, who is the founder and CEO, he was able to be quite flexible about how he gave us things that we would just, you know, send off to other places that needed it. And it really got me thinking about how much waste there was. And I mean, immediately when I first went, I was like, I just got my food from a food bank, huh? Right. You know, like, to me, I feel like the narrative we always hear about food banks are like those really sad Sally Struthers kind of commercials. And it's always like a child.
Sarah McLachlan music.
Yeah, Sarah McLachlan. Yes, I actually have that line in the show, right? Like, it's always there are people who are redeemed, and then those are who are redeemers. And the ones who are the redeemers are the ones who give to the food bank, and the ones who take are the, like, and it really kind of made me think about dignity and why so many of us always assume that there's someone else more deserving when, you know, more and more, like, student hunger is a huge issue that people don't think about. In New York City, one in, I think, seven public school students is living in a shelter or unhoused, right? Like, this is, it's it. But I think we have very dramatic images of what, who deserves that food first and foremost. Yet at the same time, 30 to 40% of the food that's produced in this country doesn't even make it to the shelf or to our table, right? It's thrown out. So, so I guess, like, it started there with me just being kind of fascinated with that and my own relationship to food and food shame and how can I talk about a food bank so it doesn't just look like a food commercial or rah, rah, rah. And I did some really incredible research. I'm excited because one of the scholars who I researched is someone named Andrew Fisher. He lives in the Portland area. He's going to be coming to the show. We've never met in person, but we've been emailing. But his book, Big Hunger, was really influential and kind of broke down that, like, there was a time pre-Reagan where hunger was only 3%. A food bank was not a normal thing. It's because so many people can't afford food and or basic needs, even if they're working full time, that we've had this phenomenon of a food bank. And it's become a great way for corporations to do tax write-offs, but not pay their workers fair wages, right? And so this is all, like, really heady, like, kind of take to the streets and scream at a building, you know, scream at the man information. And it was also an interesting challenge to figure out, okay, how can I tell the story of what this hunger looks like in a way that isn't constantly positioning someone as sad and pathetic, but also being honest to my experience, because I do not have the most dramatic experiences of food insecurity that exist, but I'm still the one who's telling the story, right? So Yeah, but I do feel like the narrative as it exists is, tends to be very one way. There's those who are saved and those who need saving, and it needs to be more than that.
Well, I can speak from personal, you know, from my childhood. My family was, you know, working class, but there was a time where we were on government food. Now, government food was a can that said meat and a can that said...
Yes, it was white with black writing. I know my grandma would get those.
Yeah. Exactly, beans. Yeah, and then here's your block of cheese.
Yeah, they give Chinese families cheese.
I know, but they give Chinese. Yeah, but my dad wasn't, you know, so, you know, cheese wasn't part of the diet, yeah. but also it was free, you know, so we did eat things that like oatmeal, which I was going, what is oatmeal, you know, you know, and all these grains and stuff, but it was actually quite healthy food.
Yeah.
You know, I remember that, and I remember how it was so shameful. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you talk about, you know, not having food stamps. A lot of people didn't want to have food stamps because it was like you had the back then, like this coupon book of fake money that you pulled out. And it was humiliating to, you know, in a grocery checkout to see. Yeah. And everybody knew that you were poor, you know. So there were those kind of issues. And they kind of solved that with the debit card, which was great.
Yeah.
But then I start thinking about how this particular administration, right off the bat, cut SNAP, you know, and I think about those poor kids that can't even have that debit card anymore, you know. So, you know, was that sort of your impetus, or did you start before that the cuts, you know, was that about the same time that you started this project, or?
Oh my God, everything you're naming. It started before all this. So this process started maybe 4 years ago, before Trump took office again, before HR1, before the $187 billion was cut over the next 10 years of SNAP spending, which I'm already witnessing all around, like on my Buy Nothing groups, you've got people who are just asking for food, right? And at that point, our set is food, canned food, which the audience can take home after. And before you go to Aldi, we could buy a bunch of cans of food and it would last through the run of the show. And now it has become so expensive to make this set. We're going to still feed everybody. I mean, you still offer the groceries to everybody, but we're just like, oh my God, like the cans of tuna that we used to have have like doubled in and I'm just like, how are we going to do this? We're going to do it. But yeah, that has been, that actually was a big curveball in the last 2 years. It was sort of the world I was addressing when I started to make the show the baseline I was addressing was that everyone was like, food banks are good. Keep giving your food bank, volunteer your food bank. These are not terrible sentiments, but I think what I got from doing deeper research, and again, I'll name Andrew Fisher and Janet Papadex, who has a book called Sweet Charity. It's like, wait, when did we become a culture that just like was like, oh, just give to your canned food drive, give to your canned food drive, give to your canned food drive. Like, when do we get to the place of like, wait, how do we get beyond just fixing hunger by throwing food at it? When do, you know, have we just totally given up that there are other ways to kind of, why do we call it anti-hunger and not anti-poverty? Why aren't we getting at the bigger legislation that is making sure everybody has enough so they can afford stuff? It's just almost like all we can do is kind of deal with things in hindsight, deal with what seems like an immediate fix, which is feeding somebody today. But we're not, you know, we're not building sort of the infrastructure that allows everybody to have everything they need all the time. And the stopgap is becoming like a permanent crutch of how we think existence is supposed to look like. So at the point that I began to sort of get into that sort of research, that became more interesting to me. But it also like follows the trajectory of past shows where I'm like, ah, yes, everything, like I think I've got the quick fix to it. And it's a giant structural issue that we have to address. The way I took all this heady information and made it more interesting as for an audience was I began to rewrite popular songs and the lyrics to sort of distill all this information with parody into music.
That's what I was going to ask you about the karaoke, you know? Yeah, yeah. It's like, why is that? Yeah, now I understand.
Yeah, yeah. How do we do this? Because there is definitely, I feel like I if I just presented the information as I had it, it would be interesting, but it would be like reading a paper to the audience. So, I mean, there's some really interesting information about how Walmart CEOs are on the board of Feeding America, but Walmart also profits hugely from SNAP. In some states, they redeem half the food stamps. And if you look at their employees, they're not allowed to unionize, right? Or they've been very much barred from unionizing, and a lot of them relying on the same benefits. So it's like, it's almost like, oh, instead of giving all this money to stop hunger, why don't they just pay their employees more so they don't have to go on food stamps, right? And so I've filtered all these facts into a song set to Alanis Morissette's Ironic. Right. And it's sort of about the great ironies of Walmart in this moment. Right. So and there's like 15 other songs like this that sort of discuss these dynamics. I'm so used to these songs, I can't even remember sometimes who the original artist is.
I watched a video of you at a food bank doing a performance, right?
Yes.
And you know, you'd start a Journey song, go, oh, excuse me, we don't know about fair use, so you can't hear the rest of the song. You know?
Yes.
And it was actually funny, you know, because it was like, oh, okay. But yeah, there were a lot of different varieties of music that you were singing. So it was fun.
He's Glenn Corrado, a world harvest food bank. Disrupted now, food's given out for free, baby. He's Glenn Corrado.
So you're referencing this short documentary that
it was about 15 minutes.
Yes, yeah. The Kennedy Center. So, okay, here's the secret. The Kennedy Center, I was an artist in residence there for 3 years. They made it. I was part of the social impact program. The Kennedy Center has a new board president, and I'll let everyone Google that.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And so the Social Impact Center is now dissolved. That documentary is hosted on my YouTube channel because basically everyone in that department was rushing to pay, you know, the last of the honorariums of the artists, give them the last of documentation they had taken for their projects. So I'm glad it was funny because I would have gone through 5 more rounds of edits with them on it, but we were just like rushed to pull everything we could.
Oh, I get it.
You know, off the hard drives.
I get it. Yeah, it was supposed to be a bigger project.
And yeah.
Then, and this administration shut everything down, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically, I mean, now the Kennedy Center doesn't even have shows.
No.
Because they need more gold in a perfectly fine building. But yeah, so this show was also developed in this 3-year residency. And I was in discussions to try to figure out how it could culminate on their main stage. And then
it's interesting.
And then basically, you know, Rome fell. So I don't even know if that's the right comparison, but yeah. But anyway, yes. So, so in the interim,
well, civilization as we knew it definitely changed.
Yes. Yeah.
I think that that's interesting. So you were on a social impact program. And so was that part of the development process too, of this particular piece?
Yes. Yes, it was developed at ASU Gamage in, which is in Tempe, Arizona. Sort of the impetus is during the pandemic, the Anti-Sewing Squad worked a lot with mutual aid organizers on the Navajo Nation, which is in the same state. It's it overlaps like 3 and I think 4 states. It's the size of West Virginia. They are a food desert. They only have 13 full service grocery stores. 130,000 tribal citizens. You imagine if you live there, you are basically relying on having enough gas in your car to go 2 hours round trip to a major grocery store to get fresh produce. If not, maybe you're going to a gas station. And you try to imagine putting together meals from a 7-Eleven, right? Like the quality of what you have access to is very limited. So some of the thinking when I started the show was this might be a chance to work more with those Navajo organizers, because they had actually asked in the pandemic, can you help us figure out how to get a food bank like yours on our reservation? And so some of that, this has been a very inside out process, because at one point I had planned to make a visual installation inside one of the gas station markets at the Navajo reservation. It's not a full service market, but it's one of those kind of go-betweens. And so I tell the story a little bit in the show, and the song that goes with it is, there's that song that I would walk 500 miles.
Oh, I love that song, The Proclaimers.
Proclaimers.
I would walk 500 miles.
See, this is where I said I forget to back to the original song. So that has been reworked to be 100 miles, which is I would drive 100 miles get to groceries. And that's sort of the creation process, came out of a lot of things, wanting to understand what it would take to bring a food bank, realizing a food bank is something that, like, you can't just bring over one shipment of food and it's done. Like, that's, you're kind of signing on till forever, until everything structurally shifts in a way that you don't need to be there anymore. And a lot of food banks, especially the major, massive, big ones, seem to be kind of content with just operating that way forever and not doing larger legislation of wanting to become obsolete.
So is the Navajo community getting a regular food bank now, or did that change?
Yeah, no. There are food banks that serve them in Arizona, but I guess they wanted maybe one of their own that they run.
Yeah.
But it's far, right? Like, it, in a place like LA, we could have a World Harvest because there's just so much, it's a major city and there's so much waste from all these major things that can funnel themselves to this food bank. But I mean, at least what I sort of looked at when I was trying to figure out how would this work? It's so far that it involves getting trucks, refrigerated trucks, and someone to run it. And someone to run it consistently for those organizers to start on. There are their own mutual aid projects, but something as large as a food bank is a big undertaking. You know, you imagine all the elements of a corporation just with none the money and keeping that going. But I do point to I find that the larger solutions are, one, legislation, slow, very difficult right now to get anything passed, but a lot of it is thinking about mutual aid and how can we combine both direct action and advocacy, right? And not get too trapped in the head of, what if we do this forever? Like, at one point, many people suggested to the Auntie Sewing Squad that we become a nonprofit. And I was like, why? Just so mad. Forever, right? Like, so I can have a gala to raise money for my salary and for our office space, and like, so that we can keep paying people nothing to sew masks. This makes no sense, right? Like, every nonprofit should be working to getting itself out of business, right? That you fix the problem, and that you don't have to go run around and do this anymore. And I think so many nonprofits lose sight of that. I'm mostly talking about food and homelessness nonprofits.
I love how you start with the micro, you know, and then go to the macro. So with your projects, and you still return to the micro, because as part of your run at Portland Center Stage and Boom Arts collaboration for Food Bank Influencer, you're also presenting a show at the Oregon Food Bank on June 1st at 1:30 p.m. for volunteers, you know, and you're encouraging people to volunteer for a shift to help out so they can watch you perform too.
Yes. I have been, you know, on this call, I've been critical of bigger food bank structures. I will say Oregon Food Bank, I find to be really interesting. They do dedicate quite a lot of their budget towards advocacy, and they measure progress. Like, a lot of food banks measure progress on how many pounds of food they've delivered, but they have different measures. I can't remember what it is. It feels kind of hippy dippy in that Portland way, but it's like a love quotient or something. Someone who works there is listening to the screaming at me right now and saying, no, it's the blah, blah, blah. But I'm really interested, because I do think that the model they have for a major food bank with a staff is a little bit more aligned to what these things should look like, where it's like, you should take political stances and and should speak up and get pissed off when there are more people showing up for food. And don't get mad at them, get mad at the circumstances that causes line to get longer, right? And instead of just patting yourself on the back for for feeding people.
Especially during the pandemic, Oregon Food Bank was very politically active. And also they had a hard time because people were afraid to volunteer, you know.
Yeah.
So they had so much need too. And they're really good about getting the word out regarding that.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that you're doing it there. They do seem to have their act together.
They're pretty cool. We'll find. Yeah.
I'm not saying we'll see,
but no. They're really cool. And so that day, that's June 1st, you volunteer and then I'll perform a little, not the whole show, but and I'm just interested in meeting with them and stuff.
Are you doing that around the country as part of this run?
Yeah, some food banks, I do better with mutual aid groups, I will be quite honest. The bigger food banks, because they get critiqued a little, just a little. Some of them are a little like, oh, you have it all wrong. We do such good work. And I'm like, I didn't say you weren't doing good work. You know, I just feel like my job is not to be a one, you know, of an evening length version of a food bank commercial, right? Like for me, I'm about like one, trying to deepen the picture of what food insecurity looks like. And then try to like have this whole conversation around dignity, which I feel like a lot of them are also dealing with, like, because people feel really embarrassed to use it. But also, like, can we get beyond feeling like we fixed everything with a canned food drive? Can we use, like, the space of a... And this is also, you know, my interest with my own local food bank. Can we change this, not just be like, yay, we gave food away. Like, can we register some people to vote? Can we educate them on why it is they've shown up here, or why it is that they ran out of SNAP benefits and now found themselves here, right? Like, and I know nonprofits can only do so much advocacy, but that is, for me, what a lot of these shows look like. Like with Auntie Sewing Squad, at first it was like, I feel so generous and I'm helping so many people and I'm saving their lives sewing a mask. And I tell you, 3 weeks in, we were getting really pissed off at like, okay, what is taking so long? Why did this proposal to have the post office deliver masks to every household get scrapped? And this further stigmatizing the masks, making our work harder. And we ended up feeling more and more that, you know, went from, oh, look at all these generous aunties sewing, to like, to really critiquing just how inept the government response was to this whole thing. And the people who kept falling the most behind in terms of getting hit the worst were people, Black and brown people who were, you know, just marginally housed. People who are, you know, housed, like farm workers, like it's all crammed into places and more susceptible to getting sick.
I sometimes feel like this. I mean, in your work, of course, you are a playwright and an actress and, you know, you're creating art. But there's also an element of the Emperor's New Clothes, where it's like, doesn't anybody else see this? You know, and I feel like that a lot. It's like, and I feel like you're pointing some of that out, you know, in a fun way, but it's still like, don't you see what is happening right around us?
Yeah. But I also feel like I'm the emperor too when I walk in and I'm like, hey, I'm going to fix this totally complicated problem with a show. Woo. And then I'm like, oh no, what have I set myself up for? And I don't want to leave people with, oh, it's so helpless, don't even try. I definitely feel like everything is a longer process than something that can be fixed by watching one show. Though if you were to watch one show to fix it, it would be mine. Plug.
Ba-dum-bum, you know?
Yeah, but you know, I do feel like it's about shifting culture altogether to be about a circular economy, to be about sharing, to be about a trust economy, a true trust economy, not an Airbnb kind of trust economy, right? But really thinking that the strength we have is us, and then that the way things get solved is not going to be a rich person writing a check. It will help. And I don't want to stop rich people from writing checks, but I think we all need to realize that we have power, even if we are the ones who are in the position of going to the food bank. Right. And I can't name all those things for you, but you have it, right. Whether it's choosing to feed your kid, or how you give dignity to someone else with your time, or where you choose to access things from. And so this sounds so abstract right now, but yeah.
You know, you present yourself learning and evolving through this process,
yeah,
and wondering about it yourself, and then asking a lot of questions and, you know, kind of conveying things with comedy, with the karaoke singing and the parody songs. But also it seems like the empowerment part comes in. Okay, so here's your info. You have a choice to do something, mm-hmm. you know, and people mm-hmm. have that choice. They can't, you know, they could just not do anything or kind of investigate their own kind of microsphere here in their neighborhood or their particular community. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good way to just impart some knowledge that you have learned, but also realizing that you are learning it at the same time. So it isn't like you're a hero. It's not a hero complex ever. Your shows aren't about being a hero. You know, it's also about you just trying to figure things out. And at seeing you do it, you know, maybe somebody else will start trying to figure things out, or maybe they have, and maybe they'll kind of pass on the baton to somebody else, you know? So I think it just presents a lot of things like what one person can do mm-hmm. is important for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say I ran for office because I was like, I didn't know what to do anymore as a playwright after 2016. I was like, oh, that satire I used to write, does it just why? we're breaking up to better headlines than what I could possibly write. And it was that whole thing. It's like, we used to laugh at comedians and listen to politicians, and now we're laughing at politicians and listening to comedians. And I was like, well, I'll run for office and get my job back as a clown. And also try to research this whole process of what it takes to run for office. And it does take a lot of money and time to run for those big offices like mayor and, you know, things you've heard of. But neighborhood council and these other small offices, you're filed to run for free and just knock on your neighbor's doors and make them go down to the rec center and vote for you. And so I did win in thanks to my Korean passing face in K-Town. And it was a very frustrating job where a lot of people dropped out because I think they thought they were going to make all this change and they didn't. Mm-hmm. They have jobs and there's no money in this thing. They've got jobs and families they got to take care of. But I sort of realized a lot of these votes are symbolic, and reporting on them is part of that symbolism. And how the way I report on, you know, how it went was my show. And so at the end of, I think the proudest thing I did in neighborhood council actually didn't exact real change, but it was this very symbolic moment where we voted to abolish ICE. And as it turns out, you can't actually take down a federal agency from inside the neighborhood council. But this sort of happens all the time when Congress people are censured, or a day is set up to dedicated to somebody, right? Like, these are all these moments of symbolic honoring and gesturing and sort of values placemaking. And I feel like it's something. I feel like change happens when a series of dominoes is like slowly set up in a row. And we shouldn't give up. And it was a really affirming meeting that we had, where all these undocumented people came and talked about their experiences, and we were all crying and kind of affirming that the reason why we ran is to protect other immigrants, because so many of the people in our neighborhood council were immigrants.
And I think you are right. It's a bunch of dominoes that you never know where it's going to land and what it's going to cause it's going to have later on for someone else. And your work is like that. But I also want to talk about, you develop your work in such an organic way, right? Looking at your life, responding to it through art. But I'm also wondering, what are you looking forward to on your next project? What's the seed here?
I don't have a next solo show plan. I've said 20 years ago, I can't keep doing this. This is exhausting. I am now like 8 or 9 solo shows. I can't believe it. I'm so pooped. I got to get on an airplane tomorrow. And all I have is like 12 pairs of underpants in my suitcase and my pills. And I'm just like, I guess I got to get the show up. But anyway, I'll have underwear on, everyone. Yeah, so I do community projects too, but I've been working with formerly incarcerated Asian Pacific Islanders, which a lot of Americans don't even think about, right? They can't name an Asian, and they certainly can't imagine why we'd ever be in prison. But we are a small but growing prison population. People think because of the model minority myth that Asians don't go to prison, and we do. But I have been on the board of an organization called API Rise, and we support current and formerly incarcerated Asian Pacific Islanders, especially as they're reentering back home. For 2 years in a row in the pandemic, I did a virtual show with our cast, who were both writing and talking about their own lives and making Zoom theater with it. And when I come back from Portland on June 8th, I will have 3 weeks to put together our first live new production. And it's script question mark. We don't know. But folks have crazy, amazing stories worth sharing. The theme is welcome back home, question mark. What is it like to come home when there are threats of ICE detention? And that has actually happened to some of our members have been deported, and they're going to be participating virtually in video they've sent in. Yeah, the threat of ICE with their families. Some of them are coming home and trying to navigate the work market for the first time, or relationships, or, you know, the relationship with their families and you know, romantic relationships. And there's no shortage of stuff. But so that's what I'm working on in addition to a podcast called Killing Your Number. So the show is From Number to Name, which is going from a prison number and get your name back. And then the podcast is Killing Your Number, was when you kill your prison number and get your name back. And that's all prison slang. And so that's sort of what I've been working on. And I have a ensemble play I've written that was commissioned by La Jolla Playhouse. That's been in a reading. But yeah, right now no solo shows, but I have stuff with people.
I don't know. I hope that you feel invigorated by this, you know?
Oh, I do. I do. I know. I don't mean to sound cranky. Like,
well, yeah, I would.
People will be like, I don't want to see this cranky woman on stage for an hour. No, I bring it. I'll have a big old smile on my face, and you'll love it.
Nothing wrong with cranky women, frankly. I love hanging out with cranky women, you know, cracking jokes. So nothing wrong with that. I'm looking forward to seeing your show. A Food Bank Influencer runs May 26th through June 7th at Portland Center Stage. It's a co-production with Boom Arts. Find out more at pcs.org and boomarts.org. And also on this post for this show on orartswatch.org and stageandstudio.org. Christina Wong, always great to talk with you. And I want you to know you're pretty loved in Portland.
Aww.
And I know that the show will be a success.
Thank you.
And so will the Oregon Food Bank performance.
Yes.
So all good things.
I'm losing my mind, but I'll see you next week, Portland.
Okay. That's it for Stage and Studio on Arts Watch. You can also find links to this, everything that we talked about, and hear this show again on stageandstudio.org or orartswatch.org. That's it for Stage and Studio. I said that already. Till the next conversation, I'm Demay Lil Roberts. And goodbye, Christina
Wong. It's going to be fine. It'll be great. I'll see you soon.
Thank you so much. This is my finale song. Thank you so much. I want to thank the staff here at World Harvest. I want to thank Arlo and Jessica and the Kennedy Center for documenting this. Just...